Welcome to another episode of If You Know Your History on FNR Football Nation Radio. I am Paul Mavridis, and with me is Ian Sison. Ian,
what?
How are you?
I'm good. I had my AZ yesterday.
AZ?
My first AZ, and it was...
And you're still here?
I'm still here. I was expecting to suffer.
I was hoping you would suffer.
Yeah, I know you were. And bizarrely, I haven't suffered at all. It's kind of weird. No dizziness, no tiredness, no headache.
I'm going to write him a letter.
No soreness. Maybe they gave me the placebo.
I doubt it, but yeah, I'm going to write them a letter and saying, where's the suffering?
Mm. Are you down to get one?
I'm not that old.
Okay. So you have to wait for Pfizer.
I have to wait for something. I don't know. I haven't got any correspondence about that.
Yeah, well, we old people, we're a bit lucky on this one, risk front, I guess.
You're lucky that you're in the most high-risk group. That's good.
Mm, yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Now, I've been doing a bit of reading during the week.
That's odd.
I know it's odd. I've been reading the Amazing Dribble Around the Northeast. That's fabulous. And you should read it because he's a man after your heart. Well, you're a man after his heart, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
who's Roy, the man?
What, Roy will remind us when he comes on later on his name. Pearson, Harry Pearson.
Okay, well, there we go.
Yeah, and it's called The Far Corner, Amazing Dribble Around the Northeast. And he goes to, you know, Premier games. He goes to local games. He goes to really poor quality games with 130 people. And it's tremendous.
130 people?
Yeah.
Wow, that's so, like double of like NPL game.
Seaham Red Star. Seaham is where When the Boat Comes In was set.
Oh, what the? I don't know what that is.
Anyway, When the Boat Comes In. Oh wow,
I'm not part of the AZ generation.
There's a the AZ generation as
yeah.
All right, well, we better get on because we've had some complaints about the banter.
No, we haven't had a whole bunch of complaints about the banter. It just should be embedded throughout the show instead of taking up 5 or 10 minutes.
Embedded banter.
Yes, okay, it should form a natural part of the conversation as opposed to, you know.
Forced.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. No forced banter.
You know, it's, anyway, usually do a clean up on these kinds of things and we get through it quickly and so we can talk
but
to.
But what I've been reading about, I read something on. I think it's on the Lost Footscray site.
Which is a closed group?
Yeah, it's a closed group. But I cut and pasted it and put it onto the soccer history. Now, tell me about the Westgate Bridge disaster.
Was it 50 years ago last year?
Yeah, it was. October the 15th, 1970, 35 men were killed when a span fell due to bizarre engineering decisions.
Mm-hmm.
When the two sides came together, they were 11 centimetres out, so they decided to put really heavy weights on the bit that was too high, and that bent it down, but it buckled the bridge a little bit, and they had to undo some bolts. Can you imagine? It's just insane. Anyway,
it collapsed during construction.
Yeah.
And it collapsed onto the workers who were having lunch or whatever underneath
and
it.
And some people rode it down as well, and some people fell. It was terrible. 35 men were killed. One of them was a guy called Bill Harburn. And I'll read out the story. It's an extract from Westgate by Bill Hitchings. Only yesterday they'd all laughed when they felt the span move. She must be having growing pains, someone said. Pat and the kids were in bed when Bob left for work. He was dead less than 5 hours later. So that's Bob, a different guy. It was still dark when Bill Harburn slipped out of bed from beside his wife Mavis and started to get ready for work. He didn't want to disturb the house. The children, Alan, Philip, Stephen, and little Vicky, would get up soon for work or for school. He'd see them when he got home from the bridge later, probably kick a football with the boys around the backyard of their home in Hay Street, Hyatt. Bill, 47, was a proud man, a keen sportsman. He'd captained the Australian soccer team once since he migrated from England in 1954, and he was still considered a handy player with his home side, Sandringham. Two of the boys played with him in the team. Maybe they too would represent Australia, but right now he had to get to his other pride and joy, the bridge. It would be a fine, cool day, so they should be able to get a lot done. It wasn't until 2 days later that they were able to identify Bill Harburn's body. He loved that damn bridge, Mavis said later. Mm. How good's that?
It's great.
And there's a whole series of them about other men. You know, little vignettes that really give them some dignity. It's kind of impressive. But you know, I'm always appealing for mythology stories that place soccer in Australian stories, and this is one.
Mm.
You know, he played three times for the Socceroos. He played B internationals. He was in the same squad as Ted Smith for the Olympics.
Yep.
In 1956. That was when he was at his peak. You know where he's from? He played for Darlington.
Oh.
He played for Darlington in England and another. He's from up Stockton, which I think is – I'm not really great with my Northumberland geography, but I think it's in Northumberland. Anyway. It'll be down in Middlesbrough, actually. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He's from the northeast and came and played for Australia, died making a bridge.
It's interesting because I think the whole collapse of the West Gate Bridge has just gone out of Melbourne memory. People don't really think about it. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people cross that bridge, or millions cross it every year.
And my mum hasn't forgotten. She does not cross the bridge to this day.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, when I was in primary school, I had a friend and his father had worked on the bridge and he survived it. I mean, the whole thing, because he stopped to have a coffee before he left to go there. And he's like, basically, he would have a coffee every time he was supposed to cross over it. It's in a superstitious kind of luck, folk custom there. I know my dad, that was the year before my dad came to Australia. So it wasn't in my mythology. But certainly for an older generation, it's something they will never forget.
Yeah.
And especially among a sort of in a class solidarity kind of thing, the working class would never forgot that because the working class bears the most risk from building these things, whether it's a building or a bridge or a dam or whatever it is. And they take immense pride in having completed that work and be able to point to that to their children and say, I built that. You know, I was there. That was me and my friends. We risked ourselves for that.
An ex-colleague of ours, Enza Gandolfo, wrote a book about the bridge, didn't she?
Yes, she did.
Yeah. I really didn't need to get and read it.
I think it's 51 years now, and it has kind of slipped out of Melbourne memory.
Yeah. We've slipped it in a little bit with Bill. And his sons were players, and his sons seem to have played for Harcoa in the 70s. And, I'll do a little bit more follow-up on that as well. Now, I periodically put prizes on Twitter, have contests on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And they're serious. I offer a prize and the prizes are real.
Mm-hmm.
And I put a photo today of Ted Smith from when he was 14 on Twitter, and I said, identify this Socceroo, and it took ages, but Jason Kalija.
Well, you excluded a whole bunch of people that would have got it.
Oh, well, you can't win every prize, Paul.
But Mark Borich got the answer right before he saw his name as one of the exclusion lists.
Anyway, Jason Kalija won the prize, and I sent him a copy of Roy's and my history of soccer in Victoria.
From
2009. And Jason asked me about Georgie's, whether there's anything about Georgie's, and I said, well, yeah, there is. And it reminded me, Jason talking about this, reminded me about Victor Brincat's history of Sunshine George Cross.
Mm.
So I went to their website today, which is a magnificent website, except it doesn't have the history.
Yep.
They've got this. He's got the best club history in Melbourne, and it's sitting there, and they don't put it up.
Mm.
I want to slap them on the wrist, Paul.
On the wrist?
Yeah, I want to drive past their ground and sing out, history haters.
Why don't you get like a megaphone and just, during a game, read it out?
Yeah. Let's go to a game and stand there.
But you can just do it from across the street.
Boom's house.
Yeah. You know somebody lives across the way.
Yeah, all right.
Just get the megaphone out and read it.
Yeah, okay.
And the people are going, what's all that about?
That's a fantastic idea. That's like, That's historical terrorism, isn't it? Or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Anyway.
I've been hanging out with too many anarchists on Twitter, I think.
Let's go to the cleanup.
Greg Stocks updated the 1977 NSL page on Us Football. I haven't had a good look at it. I mean, there's still some people disputing some of the details because I think Peter Blasby, the well-known Victorian goalkeeper, said, no, no, that wasn't Olympic Park. That was at Middle Park. And it's like, is that just memory or is that actually spot on? Who knows? Greg will have to chase that up. But I suggested that one of the things we need to make provision of once we get this fully updated and the Victorian stuff as well and whatever else comes up in the Ausfootball journey is that we should have a little a space within those results lists for the match program, if it exists, and for the footage. People putting up footage all the time. People are putting up match programs all the time. It just seems like another thing you can add to the experience to see what the context was of this game. You don't just have the names.
Is there a model in other sport?
Look, the thing I'm most familiar with is there's two websites, and one is Ultimate A-League, which is just statistics. So they, I mean, it's kind of like what Ausfootball does, but in a more modern format and more geared towards A-League stats. And the other one is AFL Tables, which is, and there's also a rugby league version of that as well, which has excellent data and statistics, but nothing like that builds narrative and context. And I think that's where Ausfootball has the opportunity to do something like that, where it can build context around the game by saying, here's the footage, here's the match program. Because there are parts of Ausfootball in results list where they actually have match reports from guest contributors. So that's something to think about in the future. Obviously, we need something a bit more secure than Mark's site, I think. And obviously, even something like Ausfootball, because Thomas Essamy, the guy who runs it, he's been he's probably getting on in years as well. Who knows about his health in the future and what happens to it once he goes. So
can't we just download everything onto a dirty, great big terror drive?
Well, maybe we can get a university to look after it. That was your plan, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was my plan.
But moving on, Mark Borich and Greg Stock have been collaborating and putting up the Northern Spirit match programs, which I think probably from Jeff Coy, I'm guessing. MelbourneSoccer.blogspot.com as usual and spread the word. Greg Werner's got a few copies of Soccer Voice from the 1980s that he's going to send Mark's way as well. He's finding things. I forgot about this. I shouldn't have sent that drive over. We've also got like a really interesting event coming up with a really silly date chosen for in time. The launch of Be My Guest by Jason Goldsmith and Lucas Gillard is on the 24th of June in Melbourne at the Imperial Hotel on Bourke Street. I hate that pub. I really do. I just cannot stand it. But it's...
got lots of Liverpool supporters in it.
That's another reason to hate it too. But I'm sure it'll be a great event when we keep public, you know, pushing it as we go along. But they put it on basically at the same time as this show is on. So I think we'll kind of take the week off and just go to that instead. You okay with that?
Unless FNR wants to send the whole infrastructure over so we can do a live broadcast.
Well, you know, they gave us these flags that used to have behind us. And they replaced them with these cardboardy things. I don't know what they are. And they're all frayed. I don't know if you noticed.
Yeah, that's flags. Nice. That's
yeah, but my mum fixed mine. Because my mum's, you know, she does basic tailoring and adjustments. Yeah. And she's like, yeah, I've seen, what's this, Paul? And I'm like, oh, it's some kind of flag from, you know, thing, the radio. And she's like, oh, this is going to fall apart if you don't get this fixed. I'll fix it for you. Then I'm like, oh, mum, this jumper's the sleeves wrecked as well. So, you know, fix that too. She goes, yeah, all right.
Good for her.
Yeah. It's her trade. So, you know, that's all I got in the cleanup. It's, but the other thing, and I know we're talking about this in the green room, and it's not exactly soccer related, right? But, our friend, one of the quiz masters out there, Manfred van McGonagall, it's not his real name, had a great discussion about, you know, the place of Australian rules in Victoria. And, you know, he's basically lived most of his life, I think, in New South Wales, Sydney.
Adelaide,
but probably not much in Adelaide. And he sort of asked this question about...
He remembers
about,
the pie floater very well. But he probably doesn't remember the pigeon, does he, the new pigeon?
No. But he asked the interesting question, do, say, Australian rules clubs have like a definitive cultural identity that they're still attached to, you know, suburban identity, cultural identity? It's like the answer is no. And it comes to me that whole idea again that people outside the state of Victoria, especially outside Melbourne, don't understand how it works in the sense that these clubs now represent themselves. They don't represent suburbs. They don't represent... you know, class or religion or anything. It's, they genuinely do represent themselves, and they're so large.
Isn't that what Baudrillard was talking about with the simulacra, where things are just copies of themselves?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I haven't read the Baudrillard. You have to, maybe Roy can, you know,
well,
give me 10 cents.
That's a nice kind of delayed segue to our next section.
But do we take a break first?
Yeah.
Okay, you're listening to If You Know Your History on FNR Football Nation Radio.
You're listening to If You Know Your History on Football Nation Radio with Ian Sison and Paul Mavridis.
Can I interrupt you first, just as we're on there? Yeah. This whole commentary from certain outside parties that we sound like a married couple, you know, bantering, bickering on air, an old married couple to wit. And this is not just even regular listeners. This is like people listening to us for the first time. This has come to my information. Just now, Ian reveal the fact that he doesn't remember my birthday is. We've been married for 15 years. Could you get any more stereotypical here as a you know, neglectful male? Anyway, go on.
Oh, and we have a very special guest. We've had him before, but it's always great to have him again. It's Roy Hay.
We've only had him once.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is it's fine. It's meeting it out, you know.
This isn't again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hello, Roy.
Hello, Ian. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Roy.
So we've got you on because there's a really, you know, bizarre is almost not too far a stretch on it, a bizarre, weird, curious moment in the 1930s when the administration of Australia, of Victorian soccer takes a bit of a turn. And I mean, I wonder, Roy, whether you want to just take up from there or you want to, how do you want to do this?
Well, we can give it a bit of context, shall we?
Yeah.
In the middle of the Depression, the crowds are down, income's down, all the codes are affected.
Yep.
The VFL went to, what was it, 108 games a season in 1927. The crowds peak at 1.8 million, and then it's downhill all the way to 1937 when they're down to about 1.5 million. So the leading code in Victoria is struggling. And if it's going down, then soccer and the other branches of footy, like the Victorian Football Association, the original association that goes way back to 1877, they're all struggling. And out of this comes some very strange things. And perhaps the strangest of all is the idea that the head of the Victorian Football Association, John James Liston, who is a mover and shaker, a disruptor of the period, decides that he will take over the running of the Victorian Amateur Soccer Football Association. I mean, he'd ideally like to take over the VFL and puts that forward as a serious proposition. He says, as long as we get them amalgamated, then that would be fine, and I'll even step aside at that point. But in the meantime, he continues with the VFA and put up by the Moreland Soccer Club, he becomes president of the Victorian Amateur Soccer Football Association and continues to be its president from then until he dies in 1944. So and he's virtually written out of the history of our game, but he's a very significant figure.
It's more than a decade.
Yeah.
Oh, no, just
under a decade.
Just under a decade, yeah. And he would have kept going, I guess, had he not passed away.
It's only death that takes him away, you know.
So can we tell us a little bit about John James Liston first? What kind of person was he? What was his background and sort of where, what was his...
Born in Roscommon in Ireland, arrives here with his parents, becomes a footballer, plays footy, grows up in Williamstown, is a member of the Catholic Young Men's Association. He's an outstanding debater, and as I say, he plays football, becomes involved with horse racing, and really becomes a significant figure, first of all, in Williamstown.
He's like the king of Williamstown, isn't he?
Sorry?
He's like the king of Williamstown. He's everywhere. He does everything.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'll go on to say that he goes above that in a moment. But, I mean, in Williamstown, he is the local mover and shaker. He gets things done. Among other things, he leads the drinkers against the Wowzers.
Good man.
Yeah, and he comes later on, he comes within one vote of becoming the Lord Mayor of Melbourne, close as that. The person you maybe think about that is better known from that era is John Wren, who was a big disruptive force in sport and society in the 20s and 30s. Liston is up there with him in terms of influence, first of all, as I say, in Williamstown, later more broadly through Melbourne and through all the sporting communities. And he becomes head of the Victorian Football Association. And it's while he's doing that in the early 30s that he says, why don't we amalgamate the codes? Now, in the depths of the Depression, all sorts of madcap schemes are put up. If you remember, the Sporting Globe ran an idea that the rugby code and the footy codes should amalgamate and play, you know, rugby union in one half of the pitch and footy in the other half, effectively. I mean, it's just madcap stuff, but it's a product of this period where all the codes were in difficulty and were prepared to at least contemplate things which in the normal lives they wouldn't even give house room to. So
that idea, Roy, was a resuscitation of one that was made earlier, like 1913, wasn't it?
That's right, I'm not saying that these things are unique and new, but what I am saying is this is a period when all the codes are under pressure. I'm writing a chapter for a book on Sir Douglas Nicholls. And Doug Nicholls is at the apogee of his footy life in the middle of this period. But how does he keep himself alive? Playing for Northcote gets him enough to survive during the footy season, but then there's no money for the rest of the year. So despite the fact he's about 4 foot nothing and, you know, weighs less than a paper bag, he signs up with Jimmy Sharman's boxing troupe for a couple of years. And, of course, you know, he's not a boxer. And he's very fast on the football field, but quite slow when it comes to punching somebody in the chops, you know. And then he gets an offer from Fitzroy, and he's, being an honest man, he's prepared to fulfill his contract with Sharman, but Sharman says, no, I'll release you from this. The Fitzroy offer could be a good one, because not only they give him his money for playing football for them, but they give him a job as the groundsman That's what enables him to survive. And in many ways, this story of an Aboriginal superstar is something you can replicate for most of the footy players, most of the soccer players, most of the rugby players of this period. They're all struggling to stay alive.
To bring it back to Liston, Roy, it's a very interesting situation because you talked about all the football codes in Melbourne and probably across Australia struggling, but certainly Victorian soccer begins struggling in the early 1930s. And certainly the Victorian Football Association is in a very poor spot in the early 1930s. Their fortunes turn around thanks to some very large spending in the late 1930s. But the early, it seems bizarre for someone like Liston to not only take up the role of, you know, head of the association in this case, which is struggling, but also soccer, which is struggling. Was he hands-on in the soccer sphere, or was he sort of more of a patron?
No, absolutely hands-on. I mean, he's one of these figures who seems to be able to do 33 jobs at once. Everything, he's involved with it. The only comparison I can come up with is the brief period when Jeff Kennett decided he would become the head of soccer between 1997 and 99. Now, I mean, you would expect him to be occupied with other things, yes, but he was actually hands-on in that. And Eddie Everywhere, Maguire, I mean, he's another one who has a finger in lots of pies and, you know, does in one lifetime, which you would think would take four normal people to do.
He was very broad-minded, wasn't he? Because he was obviously the head of the Williamstown Football Club, the Cricket Club, the Williamstown Racing Club, which at that time was still had some prestige, doesn't exist anymore. You know, he was an MCC trustee.
Yeah.
He had always his business interests. He had his own horse racing interests. You know, there's probably, you know, there's a stool, a trophy named after him at Sandown, a race of the Liston Stakes, I think.
Yeah. There are soccer trophies as well.
Who knows where they are now.
Well, exactly, yeah.
When you say that he was sort of fair income, I wonder. I mean, maybe I'm being a devil's advocate here or something, but in 1933, he makes a pronouncement that if the VFL doesn't help the VFA get its stuff together, they'll think about converting to soccer or rugby.
That's a good negotiating position.
So it's brinkmanship.
Yes.
Yeah, it's, but, you know, it seems like nobody took him seriously. Or
yeah, but then he does things. For example, he manages to get some money out of the Football Association in England. He welcomes the 1937 team that comes out to play here. He is a mover and shaker, and his tentacles, as I say, reach as far as Lancaster Gate in London.
So your theory, Roy, is that his pronouncement about shifting to soccer, maybe that catches the attention of the Moreland people, and they enter into discussions with him about it, and then they suggest that he comes over.
Yeah. You have to realise that there is a situation within soccer where that can happen. I mean, Harry Docherty, whom you remember and know about, that who more or less recreated the game just in the decade before the First World War, he has actually been eased out of the soccer community. He was head of their tribunal and was criticised for wanting Richmond to be relegated to the second division for playing ineligible players and so on, and also finishing up at the bottom of the league. And he was criticised by the then president, and as a result said, well, you know, I can't continue in this role. So he resigned. The whole of the tribunal went with him.
When was this, Roy?
This was in 1933.
Well, that's the vacuum that...
This is when there is an opportunity for someone with a bit of dynamism to be seen as a saviour, if you like, of soccer. And, you know, you've got to remember that while these codes are often antagonistic, often at each other's throats, the participants in both of them, or all three of them, if you include rugby as well, all three of them, at the personal level, managed to get on quite well because people play both codes, people move back and forward and so on. So the idea of amalgamation is not quite as far out as we might think today. I mean, we can't conceive of the AFL amalgamating with Football Australia under any circumstances.
It's interesting, Roy, because obviously this is soccer's idea and it's the Moreland Club. And it's kind of interesting because the Moreland Club is quite new at the time. They've split off from Brunswick. Mm. So they're a relatively recent addition to Melbourne soccer in an environment.
And not half-bound as a result, I think. Yeah.
Yes. Now, obviously, soccer is happy to have someone with the connections and the influence of a Liston, mm-hmm. but the Australian rules people are not particularly fond of this move, are they? Especially the Northcote club.
Well, remember, you know, we look back from the position of the AFL today. I mean, something like this would be just quite inconceivable. They weren't as far ahead of the pack in the 30s, 20s and 30s, as they are now. And they were very worried about what was happening because a lot of their players, constrained by the Coulter Law, were heading off to remote parts of Victoria where they could get more money playing for local teams. Their crowds, as I say, have stagnated or are declining. There are big debates about the grounds on which they're playing, which is much of the focus here. So it's not like now where you would feel that the AFL would just crush any opposition by stamping its foot. Wouldn't need to do much more than that. In the 20s and 30s, the relative positions of the codes were not so extreme.
Mm. And to be fair, Port Melbourne, Prahran and Coburg all wrote to the VFA saying congratulations to Mr. Liston for being open-minded.
Open-minded, broad-minded. Yeah. I mean, there was support within the association.
Did they mean it, though? Did they mean it? That's what I'm getting at.
Well,
is this diplomacy?
It's obviously diplomacy. I mean, there's no doubt about it, but I think there is a genuine element to it as well.
But you say Port Melbourne was in favour. Yeah. They were happy with it. But in 1936, 37, the Port Melbourne president, who's also like the mayor of Port Melbourne, says, no, we don't want this new club forming in the South Melbourne area to play at North Port Oval.
Okay.
So they end up at South Melbourne.
Remember, for the Port Melbournes of this world, the real enemy is the VFL.
Yeah.
It's not soccer.
Yeah. And Liston makes that quite clear. I love what he says at the end. Mr. Liston said he had no explanations to make and no apologies to offer. He regretted the personal note in the Northcote motion. That's right. Yeah. You can imagine someone saying that.
It's really interesting because as weak as the VFA was at the time, Northcote was its dominant club on the field, not off it, certainly. They were a poorly attended and supported club for many years, but off the field, they'd won about five premierships in about a 10-year period. It was their most successful period. So for Northcote to come out and say this, it's not a glib statement. They feel like they have some sway here and some influence.
Yeah.
It's we said before that the VFA's fortunes changed in the late 1930s in an unsustainable kind of way because they spent a lot of money attracting players from the VFL. Soccer's fortunes don't go the same way, do they? I mean, in Victoria, they sort of the game is in decline.
Well, it's certainly not increasing. I mean, if you take somewhere like Geelong, they have a flourishing competition through to about 1929, and then it just falls apart. And thereafter, they're only able to field a single team under the Geelong banner.
But there is this phenomenon around Australia, isn't there, Roy, of spikes happening in the 30s, spikes of interest, where associations get super confident about the future in 36 and 37 for some, you know, probably because of the tour. But so there's this up and down, and I think it's a sort of dark age in our understanding, at least. We don't really know exactly what happened, do we?
Exactly, and that's what I've been telling you over the last decade. You'd really need to do the 1930s, mate.
he's like my dad.
But it's interesting. But I mean, I suppose the difference here between the VFA and Victorian soccer is that the VFA can get players from the VFL, which is what they do. They offer huge amounts of money to VFL stars. They attract a number of them across. Leading goal kickers, Brownlow medalists, players who, if they stayed in the VFL, would have become even more legendary than they already were.
Might have played for Australia.
Well, several Collingwood players left to play for Liston's Williamstown.
Really?
Yes.
So the Catholic pipeline.
Des Fothergill, Ron Todd, who was like the successor, obvious successor to Gordon Coventry.
Right.
And they ended up going to Williamstown and Port Melbourne, Peran, and all these other clubs because they got good jobs on the railways or whatever the case might be.
Yeah.
Whereas soccer doesn't have that same kind of player depth, and because obviously the Great Depression causes a hit in migration, the original migrant clubs, the Scottish clubs, your Durhamese clubs, you know, they're starting to fall away, aren't they, Roy?
Yes and no, because there are the beginnings of the signs of works clubs appearing. Happens in the latter part of the 30s because employers see that this is some way that they can perhaps ameliorate some of the pressures that they're getting on the wage front. You know, give them welfare rather than wages because you can turn it on and off like a tap. And you get the works clubs, you know, like Metters and ICI beginning to take part in the leagues and winning the league.
And Netherfolds, the Screws, as they were called. And you also have the start of school soccer, like, you know the technical schools started coming into it. And obviously you have situations like South Melbourne United where native-born Australian players are starting to come through, and obviously the war disrupts all of these things. But they haven't made the transition yet from a very much a migrant game to a local game, whereas Australian rules in Melbourne has that advantage from generations, doesn't it?
And it's still largely a participant
yes.
game. It isn't a major spectator sport. Mm. I mean, when Scotland plays England, which happens once a year, they have a trophy for it as well. That's another lost trophy, Ian.
Yep.
You get big crowds for that, multiple thousands for that. But normally, it's three men and a dog, you know, and you can't really keep the income that comes through the gate does not keep you going.
No. So, James John Liston dies in 1944.
Mm.
What happens to Victorian soccer in the immediate aftermath?
It's kept alive by Harry Armstrong and, to a lesser extent, Harry Doherty, who comes back briefly. And there's really just a holding operation going on for most of the war.
What's interesting, Roy, is that I've read a couple of things in Trove about one of Liston's sons, John Ernest Liston, who seems to be parachuted into a number of JJ's, you know, former roles. So he becomes part of the racing community and part of soccer as well.
He's in soccer as well. That's news to me.
I don't know how much interest he has in it. He served during the war, captain in the AIF. Yeah. But what I read about him is he seems like a very strange fellow. He's a Xavier graduate, Ian, so you know that might explain some of it. Okay. But you know, he dies in a car crash in the early 1950s, which he was a passenger in, but he might have caused the crash. But he seems to be parachuted into this in about 1944, 1945, as a chairman or president or something. It's very strange.
As far as I know, he didn't have a role. Thanks to some of Mark Borich's work, we've got virtually a complete run of office bearers. And I certainly don't see another Liston in that list, but I'll go back and...
I'll send you the links, Roy, if I can find them again.
Yeah, please.
The widow of Mr. J.E. Liston, the Melbourne solicitor who died in a car crash 18 months ago, is left £500,000 under his will just published.
Yeah.
Soccer could have used that.
Yeah.
he was a solicitor in his own right. But he died in that car crash because he grabbed the steering wheel of the driver because he was very nervous, and they were going around a bend and they flipped the car.
Oh.
They'd only had 4 beers. So that was counted as being sober at the coroner's inquest.
The and a bottle of scotch.
it's an interesting story, and there's obviously more to uncover as well. I mean, obviously, anybody's interested, we'll have to go into the Williamstown files in the Historical Society there and at the Williamstown Library.
I'll email this to you, Roy. I've just found it. Soccer officials. Officers elected to the VSFA are President Mr. J.E. Liston. Chairman, Mr. W.A. Cumming. Treasurer, Mr. J.O. Wilshaw.
When is that?
1945.
Right.
And that, good people, is an advertisement for Trove.
Yes.
Yeah. I just found it.
That's probably the one I've corrected.
Yeah. And I'm just sending it to Roy now.
Okay, good. this is just happening in real time.
Real time research.
You reckon it's sent by messenger pigeon?
Oh, yeah. That'll be a backup.
I think we're running out of time.
Yeah, I think we are. I think we are, Roy. Thanks. Thanks so much, Roy. That was edifying.
Well, we've done Harry Doherty with Roy, and now we've done James Liston and John Liston. And who next, I wonder? Harry Armstrong, maybe. Maybe Wilshaw. Who knows?
Can I sign off with something?
Yeah. Go ahead.
What happened in March 1933, when the Bodyline Cricketers were about to leave Melbourne on the return after that, shall we say, teethy series with the Australian cricketers.
They played a game of soccer against Harkoa.
They did indeed. And the score was?
3-1.
4-1 to Harkoa.
That's a good result for Harkoa.
Yeah.
And if you think what else was happening in March 1933?
I'm lost for words. I wasn't there.
Hitler came to power in Germany. And in the same month, the Jewish team in Melbourne was hammering the English cricketers, all of whom were good footballers as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, for that, we have to sign off, Roy. We'll catch you next time.
Yeah.
Just leave us on a real cheery note, Roy. Thanks.
Good night, gentlemen.
I've got the song from Dad's Army going through my head now.
Oh, no. Before Ian starts singing, I'm going to take a break. This is If You Know Your History on FNR Football
Roy.
Nation Radio.
See ya.
Welcome back to If You Know Your History on FNR Football Nation Radio, and now it's time for
100 years ago today.
after Roy, it's a bit of a sort of climax, isn't it? It's like we had the high priest there of Australian soccer history. And
you venerate him too much. He's just a man.
Just a man.
Just an ordinary man like you and me.
Just a man looking for a girl.
There wasn't an invitation to sing.
Yeah. No. That's sort of something like...
You were halfway to singing.
No. What's the movie, Josh? It's Notting Hill. Yeah, anyway. 100 years ago today was the 13th of May, 1921. And we're going to Hobart. Okay, and
for that thriving competition.
That thriving competition. The way this is written, it sounds like the most complex and massive competition, but when you realise how many clubs are playing, there's five clubs, one with the reserve team. Okay, so today's matches, Division 1, Corinthians versus South Hobart at the showground. Division 2, Hobart versus South Hobart at South Hobart. Okay?
This is like cricket, and the seconds and the thirds and the fourths all play different grounds, right?
Yeah. The result of the senior match at Elwick this afternoon will have an important bearing on the Cottrell Dormer Cup competition, and that cup is also missing, Paul Hunt informed us during the week. In the event of South Hobart proving successful, all the teams will be bracketed together with an equal number of premiership points. Talk about padding.
How is it missing in Hobart?
What's that?
How is a trophy missing in Hobart? It's not that big.
Yeah, how's a trophy missing anywhere? But a win for Corinthians would give that team a very useful lead. In the second division, Hobart could only muster a weak team for their first match last Saturday, but they've got together a good side for today's game and are confident of repeating the success of the senior team. Last season, so there's only four clubs because there's a Hobart senior team and a Hobart junior team. Jeepers. Last season, state champions, South Hobart, sustained their first defeat in a league match since 1919. It's only 2 years. It sounds dramatic. It is. It's just such a long time.
When you're playing against three other clubs.
Yeah. It was a thrilling contest and undoubtedly one of the fastest exhibitions of the game seen in Tasmania. It is pleasing to learn that Cadbury's have started a team. And their first practice match will take place at Claremont this afternoon. A number of experienced players are at the works and the new club should be further strengthened by further arrivals from the old country. It is certainly time that the association properly organised the C-grade competition. There are a great number of youngsters playing the game in Hobart. So where are they playing? What are they doing?
I don't know.
And representation has been made to the TFA that the Honeysett Cup should again be made available for competition. The association must bear in mind that the boy of today is the man of tomorrow.
Is he?
Okay, now, the land of...
Would you think the Cadbury players, if they got paid, would get paid in chocolate?
Possibly.
Oh, it'd be fantastic.
They'd probably get chocolate at halftime.
I'm playing for that team.
Okay. Okay, well, off to the land of the pigeon statue over in Adelaide.
Mm.
Football.
Did you see the pigeon statue when you were there?
Yeah, I loved it.
Did you touch it?
Yeah.
Was it burning hot or anything?
No, but... When it was first put up, somebody attached an object to it. That's probably not appropriate for me to say on this show.
Oh, okay.
It was an aid. It was an assistant thing.
Mm.
Yes. So nice. I love those statues in the mall. Mm. There's the pigs in the bin, and there's two big balls.
Saying, I keep saying you should go back to Queensland. Like, you think you should just go move to Adelaide?
Yeah, well, that's where my daughter lives.
I think you just like it there. It's not slower pace.
I like Adelaide.
You know, kind of antique.
Better food?
For you, yeah.
Well, how do you know? You've never been there, Mr. Myopia.
I am myopic. Thanks for the sledge.
It's okay.
You're making fun of my disability now.
Oh, stop it.
I can't see.
Okay. Following are the soccer football...
Good luck tomorrow.
What's that?
Good luck with tomorrow.
Following are the soccer football fixtures for Saturday. North Adelaide versus Prospect at McKinnon Parade. Sturt versus Glenelg at Wayville. South versus Ports at Hutch Street. Cheltenham a bye.
Mm.
Okay, so that's Adelaide. That's all we have.
Well, they're doing something. It's nice.
Yeah, yeah. Fremantle. British Association. The Fremantle Caledonians played their first away match against Perth City and had to admit defeat by 5-0. The score was not a true reflection of the play, as up to the last 20 minutes, although City showed the best football, the game was fairly even. The Callies have not yet been able to put their full strength in the field owing to one reason and another. And as a number of players have to be tried out yet. It will be a few weeks before the team is properly settled down. The game on Saturday opened in a downpour of rain and the conditions were all against good football. It was evident from the start that training would tell, and so it turned out Callies were obviously leg weary at the finish, whereas City looked as if they were only beginning.
Can I just say, how many excuses do these people want to make for themselves? This is so far ahead of its time. In the sense that this is what modern football PR does for every club.
Yeah.
You know, we had this excuse and that excuse and whatever, and then the tweet will be, well, we go again next week.
Yeah.
You know, just not acknowledging that, you know, you were crap.
Yeah.
Because you can't, because the PR just won't let you do it.
Yeah, well.
I'm off the Caledonians. This is just not being honest.
No. There's an interesting follow-up to this.
Oh, okay.
The backs deserve a special pat on the back for the way they stood up to what must be considered one of the best forward lines in the league. The next game is against College on the East Fremantle Oval on Saturday. The Students are a lively lot and have been doing well this season, and as Callies expect to have out their best team so far, a game worth watching is expected. And we go to Saturday and we get the result.
Oh, you're just skipping ahead now, are you?
No, we're going to the Saturday. This is on the Friday.
Oh, okay. So
and the results given on the Saturday evening paper.
Mm.
Fremantle Caledonians 7, Claremont College 1.
Oh.
So there's a turnaround from 5-0 defeat to a 7-1 victory. And the team they beat the previous week, they had a ridiculous form shift as well. So it's kind of bizarre things happening. Now, I'm going to go to Melbourne now because we've had some games being played.
That's nice.
And I want to read out the results as I did last year. But I'm going to read 2 weeks out because I want to catch up. I'm a bit behind. And I want to read out the first week. Okay, and then I'll go to week two, and then I'll be up to date. So on the 7th of May, 1921, the results were Albert Park 0, St Kilda 0, Melbourne Thistle 3, Preston 0, Footscray Thistle 6, with Issard scoring a hat-trick, Spotswood 1, Northumberland and Durham 1, Windsor 1. So that's a draw to start the year. In League 2, Brunswick 2 beat St Kilda A 0. Windsor A 5 beat Yarra Falls 2. So Windsor are looking like a strongish club with a good second team. And they drew the mighty Northumberland and Durham in the seniors. Welsh United 4, St David's 0. Okay, so that was the first week of the season. Week 2, Melbourne Thistle 2. St Kilda 1, Windsor 3, Spotswood 0, Footscray 1, 0. League 2, Brunswick 10, Preston A 0, Thistle A 2, St Kilda A 0, Windsor A 4, St David's 1. So I know how this season ends, and these results are a sort of interesting predictor.
So you looked ahead, did you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, just ruined the whole magic of this.
No, I don't. But no, it's not an absolute predictor. There's some – you can draw a line through some of it, but you can't draw a line through others. So I'm not telling you which ones you can draw a line through. That's a betting term.
That's okay. We've got betting ads now, so, you know, I have to buy in as well. It's for the good of the station.
Yeah. Well, and that's my 100 years ago today. I enjoyed this week's 100 years ago today. It was a bit snappier, and you had
there was chocolate in it. It was good.
Yeah, interesting things to say. And
I had interesting things to say. That's not.
No.
It was snappier, and I had interesting things to say. So yeah, that's unlike every other 100 years ago today.
I was also incredibly rude, for which I apologise.
No, it was all right. I took it the wrong way deliberately.
I wasn't talking about your disability. I was talking about your mentality.
I know.
Yeah. So you were sulking on purpose.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Well, it's time to go then.
Okay. All right.
Great banter.
Yeah. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.